Welcome to Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath, just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment. And doing this intentionally can create that same magic. Our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. Now, before we begin, here's a word from our sponsor, Meditation for Leadership. We all feel it. The pressure to keep up, to perform, to push through. But lasting success doesn't come from speeding up. It comes from slowing down, leaning in, and creating the space to lead from within. That space is where we shift from autopilot to intention, building mindful habits that strengthen focus and calm. It's where we stay connected to our values and purpose, choosing to respond instead of react. It's where we unlock our potential to positively shape our own lives and empower others to grow and thrive. That's the work of Meditation for Leadership. If you're ready to create the space for sustainable success, visit meditationforleadership.org. Hi there. Clayton Platt with Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. And today I am extremely thrilled to have a very special guest, Sarah Plattfinger, who is the director of Chopra Yoga and the Gaja Collection, as well as the co-founder of Ishta Yoga and the co-author of a fabulous book, Living in the Light. Sarah is also my niece, which makes me extremely happy and has for quite a number of years. So, Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And I am overjoyed to be your niece and for you to be my uncle and to be able to share this time with you.
It is a very interesting journey that brought us here today, and we'll probably touch on some of that. But before we get to that, I was thinking back of you telling me this story about how when you were, I don't want to say a fairly new yoga teacher, but you were a new mom, mm-hmm. and you were teaching yoga in New York, and you couldn't get a babysitter for this particular time. And so someone was watching Satya outside the studio, and she wasn't happy. And you could hear her, and you had to deal with it in the midst of teaching a yoga session. And I wonder if you could take us through that story, because it really underscores dealing with mindfulness in real time.
Yeah, it was, you're right. I think she was probably 3 or 4 months old. I got back to teaching pretty quickly after my daughter was born. It was maybe after 10 or 12 weeks. And she was little, and she didn't want anybody to hold her other than me and, her nanny at the time, who was unable to make it to watch her. And I had a responsibility to teach this class. It was a little late in the game for me to find a sub. So I had someone come with me to the studio, and I started teaching my class. And as I was teaching, we noticed, and of course, as a new mom, I was very attuned to my daughter, and I heard her crying and crying and crying, and she would not stop. Nothing. Yeah. And I was kind of peeking by the door as I was teaching, trying to see if there was a try this toy and shake her a little bit. Finally, I realized, you know what? She just needs me to hold her, because that was the only thing that would quite silence her in those days. So we did a little handoff at the door. I took hold of her. I bounced and swayed her as I finished teaching the class. And it was a beautiful moment of, yeah, connecting to that part of you that is loving, connected, in touch with a more sensitive energy, because that is what parenting is. That's also very much for me what teaching yoga is. It's connecting at the heart. And I was able to do both, fortunately. I would not choose that again, because I would love to be able to have a little more attention on my students, but they were very patient and Satya eventually calmed down. So she enjoyed the class as well.
And I do think that's such a marvelous example to me of being in the moment teaching, but having that, shall we say, that metacognition of awareness that, okay, something else is going on that needs my attention, and being able to take a pause in a way and say, okay, I've got a class, I've got a daughter, how am I going to handle this and do it with grace and being attentive to everyone who needed you at that moment. And that's asking a lot, but it, to me, is a wonderful demonstration of being present. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could just imagine the feeling being a teacher in my way, right? Things come up, and just allowing yourself to say, okay, what's needed now?
Exactly. And it's, I think, this dance a little bit, both parenting and teaching and life in general, you know, it's a dance, and we think we know all the moves and the choreography and we practice it a few times and we're ready to go. But in any given moment, we don't know what sort of obstacle will come up, what conflict will happen. And so just being, as you said, present and awake and alert to what is the next right action. And oftentimes I realize as I grow and evolve, it's not something that comes from your mind. It's often the right action that comes from a heart-centered space, maybe even a gut, right? Instinct at your navel. But it's not something we can necessarily plan. And so I'm grateful for the practice that has given me those skill sets of just being present and attuned to the now and what is available to me and what is needed of me in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you and I have talked about the fact that sort of my approach to this podcast and a lot of the teaching I do is it's informed by the Dharma, it's informed by the teaching of the Buddha, it's informed by many teachers with a great grounding in the, you know, millennia old or 2,600 years worth of teaching. And yet what I see my role is to kind of make it accessible. And your example of someone who's steeped in it, you've studied it, you know, you've made it such a huge part of your life, and yet you can demonstrate practice comes into real life at times when you least expect it.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we practice, right? It's not like we practice to ready ourselves for the biggest teaching moment or, you know, the students. There's a really great quote that I love from this teacher called Judith Lassiter. She's a restorative yoga teacher, been teaching for many, many years. And she said this quote once that really stuck with me. She said, "We practice for our students and we teach for ourselves." And it sounds a little bit maybe counterintuitive, but the point is that the practice is readying us to be very present for our students so that when the moment comes that we do teach or we are, you know, in a position where we're holding a responsibility, we don't feel that pressure. You know, teaching for me is a joy. It is something that I want to share with others, but I also do it for the love of the teaching and not needing to get feedback or response from someone else. Did I do a good job? Was it what you needed? Did I perfect it? You know, as a former gymnast, that was a little bit of my conditioning. And I just really love that quote to really ground in the practice and that's informing the students.
I love that. And you mentioned gymnastics, and that reminds me of in some respects, the journey that led you to yoga, and I had this memory, and you'll forgive me, it's very tender to me, but one of my first memories of Sarah was upside down and at my mom's house and is unable to stay on her feet, but had to be on her hands, you know, doing cartwheels, somersaults, headstands. And I just would love you if you could sort of, if you remember that journey, and I know you do, what was sort of the stimulus, the need for you that might have kind of provoked being upside down? And then how did that kind of the steps into gymnastics and then into yoga and eventually into the life that you're living?
Yeah. I mean, I have such fond memories of that home and that location and of Gran, your mom, my grandmother, and of going upside down. It really, I think any adult who knew me at that age, between the ages of maybe 7 and 12, I was definitely upside down more than right side up, or at least I desired to be. You look at home videos of me, I was cartwheeling, back walkovering, back handspringing. It drove my parents crazy. I realize now that for me was a way of shifting my consciousness. I was a very intense child. I felt things very strongly. I was very sensitive, very empathic. I didn't often know what to do with my feelings. I definitely journaled. That helped a lot. But this movement and shifting my perspective to the world or to my relationship to the earth, it helped evoke and provoke different feedback loops inside of me that helped, I think, move energy along. It helped me to free up some of the mental intensity that I carried as a child. And I know now that doing some of those moves were like my yoga. It's like a yoga pose, a yoga asana is, in a sense, literally a seat of awareness, a shape of consciousness that you're doing, or I don't want to say perform because it's not a performance, but you're embodying to evoke a certain feeling, a feedback loop within you. And it's not that we want to escape the feeling that comes up or change it or mute it or make it something else. But the power of the asana, of the yoga asana, is that it enables us to sit with the feeling, to abide in that experience and move through it and come on the other side of it with more information, more knowledge, more understanding, a deeper intimacy with ourselves, which of course opens up more intimacy with others. So yeah, that definitely was something that I didn't realize at the time, obviously, was a way of me coping with intense feelings, but in retrospect, it was.
Yeah. And you were a very high level performer in gymnastics and performing at state level championships. And I can't imagine you didn't have moments of dealing with mind chatter and self-doubt and all that stuff. Of all the sports, I would think you're performing alone for a team often, but sometimes just for yourself individually. But looking back, do you see, you know, you're finding ways to kind of deal with that? And again, dealing with the storm, but not identifying yourself as the storm, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was definitely an element of concentration. When I think about the balance beam, for example, this 4-inch wide apparatus that's about 4 feet above the ground, and walking on that and going upside down and jumping and spinning. When I was on the beam, I couldn't hear a thing. I didn't know what was happening. I wouldn't hear a music playing or the flash of a camera or any smells. My senses were completely withdrawn. And that experience is actually one of the limbs of yoga. It's called pratyahara, sense withdrawal, right? It's the experience before moving into deep meditation, different states of awareness in the meditation. And so the balance beam for me was an experience of pratyahara, of sense withdrawal, where I quieted the whole world around me disappeared. And it was just me and the beam. And I had this one-pointed focus where I could connect fully to that 4-inch-wide apparatus and do whatever it is that I needed in that present moment to stay balanced and stay centered. So as much as there was preparation in moving into the different events, sometimes it was just the action of doing the gymnastics. And one of the quotes we say about yoga is that it is skill in action. I feel like that's very much what gymnastics was for me, skill in action. And that skill is what I took with me off the mat, just as I do now in the yoga practice, and that I help other people to do as well. You know, you take your experience and bring it into life, and it informs you.
Was there any sort of routine ritual that you did in preparation for being on the beam that kind of reminded you? Because I'm thinking about, you know, when I'm sitting on the cushion in, it's actually in my office.
Yeah.
But when I'm sitting on that cushion, there's a reminder in my body, this is where I am. So I'm just, and athletes often have little things. Was that something that was, you know, part of your routine? Do you have memory of that?
What I remember most, I think, is it's really hard to explain, but it's just a very present moment awareness of this step, this handstand, this lowering the foot down, this stepping forward. So I think more than kind of preparation, it was just an arrival in the present moment with every movement and every step. And I think for athletes or runners or even musicians, right? Anyone that practices something that is high level, that is very much part of their everyday experience, and they're maybe training in an elitist way, a way that is for more elite practitioners. I think there is this quality of moving beyond the cerebral mind, because as soon as you are in that or in the chatter, you'll lose the skill, right? Because the skill is not an intellectual experience. It's, right? It's like, it's an embodied experience, just like meditation when you're on your cushion. So I think there's like a transcendent experience that came for me with doing gymnastics that informed me in, you know, the practice that I have right now in yoga and meditation.
Yes, it's, I think what I hear you describing, the flow.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And the flow can happen for athletes. It can happen for performers. It can happen in the workplace. And all the preparation in the world is needed to build that skill. But whatever it is that brings you, as you, I think you described, in that moment, all of the prefrontal cortex quiets. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite jazz musicians, Keith Jarrett, who's a fabulous improv pianist, and he talked about them taking functional MRIs of people, himself, I think. And while he was playing improv, his executive mind, the PFC, was quiet. Because among other things, it's not judging. It's not It's not trying to plan ahead. It's just allowing, as you described, everything that you've rehearsed, everything that you've practiced to flow.
Yeah.
And I think I was just picturing you. It was so beautiful. I was picturing you with this step. And that is absolutely in that moment, this step, this breath, and being able then to translate that into yoga and into the practice of life. Huh?
You know what it is too? I think that we get in our own way sometimes, and we overthink things or we overdo things. And so much of the spiritual practice, the yoga practice, but in a way, like mastery, right, is sometimes like getting out of your own way and letting that brilliance, the genius, the wisdom, the flow, whatever you want to call it, letting it come through. And it is a bit of a dance, you know, of like you show up, you do your part. That's why you do the practice, you do the rehearsals, or you have your gymnastic practice on the mat that you prepare and you tend to regularly. But then there's this other element, and I don't think we talk about it as much in our culture because it's not of service to, you know, capitalistic culture, but surrender, you know, like letting go of the need to control the outcome and allowing this higher force, whatever you want to call it, could be energy, could be creative force, God, wisdom, to let it move through you, right? And it's almost like this co-creation that you're showing up and doing your part, you're letting go of the results. And then I think that flow happens, and there's no way to fail when you do it that way. You know what I mean? Mm. There's just no failing. There's just, you know, showing up and doing your part and allowing that organizing intelligence of the universe to organize the details for you.
And just paying attention.
Yes.
Right? And I think about that. I love that sense of letting go. Anything in my life that I did reasonably well typically was without control and without self-judgment.
Yeah.
And just saying, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, the results be damned.
Yeah.
And just say, and there's a couple of things in here too. I'm hearing like, if you're doing that, you're really enjoying it.
Yes. Right?
If you let go and just allow this to happen, you can fully participate emotionally in a very positive way, and the gratitude and all that. Yeah, I really see that.
Yeah. And it is, you know, I think if we don't have joy in what we're doing, we won't pursue it. You know, it is one of the main values in Vedanta and the ancient Vedic texts that are the origins of yoga. They have these four aims of life. And one of the aims of life is joy, pleasure. It's called kama. And if you don't have pleasure and joy in what you're doing, it's very hard to commit to it and follow through on it. So I love that you brought that up. I think it is something we sometimes, in this pursuit of success or achievement, we override it, or we think like the joy will come after. The joy will come when I get the prize or the end goal. And we know like it's an inside job, right? Joy is the path there. If you're not feeling joy getting there, you won't find it once you're there. So yeah, it's a value system.
Yeah. And I was just thinking about, you know, watching professional athletes and the ones that are struggling in the moment, the big moments, and thinking, you know, there's so much pressure. Some of them get paid so much money and they're trying to justify this. and the ones sometimes that just flourish, they take a moment sometimes to breathe and say, oh my God, where else would I want to be?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Where else would I want to be but right here? And, you know, there's a ton of pressure and there are 60 million people watching me and there's $6 million on this putt, but what a privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, you know, at the end of the day, I think this is what yoga meditation teach us is like at the end of the day, all you have is your inner space, you know? Even if you get that trophy, if you don't get that trophy, if you, you know, proceed with that, nothing is, I know this is such a teaching of the Buddha, nothing is permanent. You can only expect that things will change. So really tending to that inner space, the inner realm, and finding a consistent home there, you know, that you can return back to, that is welcoming and kind and loving, despite whatever happens externally. That's everything to me. Where I am right now in my life, that is, for me, the gold is the inner realm, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And thinking about how all of the wonderful work that you do in your practice and your teaching and appreciating the moment and demonstrating and I think modeling mindfulness in real time, I was thinking about the different aspects of your life. So you were talking earlier about all the stuff you have going and planning and trying to be organized, et cetera, being a mom and being a wife and a daughter and how in so many different ways, all the preparation of your practice plays out in this. And if you would, I'd love, you know, kind of walk through that in some ways that resonate with you, some challenges and how that shows up for you.
Yeah, I really think that motherhood is like the biggest spiritual teaching, you know, or all the lessons I learn through parenting, motherhood. It humbles you, you know, as you and Pam know only so well. You could definitely teach me a few lessons on it, but you know, it's sort of like that being in relation with another being and a little being that's finding their way in the world and developing their own unique self, different to you, independent of you. My daughter is now 13. She'll be 14 in September. It is a very critical age. I don't know if you want to remember that when you're a kid.
I'm going to self-filter on dealing with my daughter between the ages of 12 and 15.
I mean,
that's my gift to her.
Yes, I can only remember Kelsey with love, and she is an amazing person. Your daughter, my cousin. But it's a challenging time. And so you want to give your kids limits and boundaries and teach them how to make good decisions. And at the same time, you want to give them the autonomy and the empowerment to make decisions and accept responsibility when they make decisions that aren't for their highest good. For me, I think the biggest challenge as a mom is, again, this aspect of control, letting go, even if I know that there is an outcome that could be better than what she's choosing, let her choose make the choice that is maybe a different outcome than what I would choose. And learn from it and grow from it, digest it. And I will be there, right? I'll be there to support her, to remind her that she's not alone. and that we all make poor decisions, and that part of life is going through the hard stuff and the challenge and the pain, to not run away from it. So, you know, we want to shield our kids from the pain. And that for me has been really an illuminating teaching of motherhood, letting Satya make her own decisions and feel the consequences of it, and then being there in love, full love and presence when she needs my support. So it's a balance of limits and boundaries and autonomy. But I do, you know, I do always return back to my daily practice as a fortifying, I guess, tool for me to help me through the challenging times as a mom or as a wife. I ran a business for 14, 15 years, a yoga studio in New York City. And that also was a huge challenge and taught me a lot about my blind side. I think sometimes with yoga and meditation, it can be easy for us to sort of, I guess the word is bypass, right? The challenges or the relationships that bring up triggers inside of us. And what I find so redeeming about running a business, about parenting, about being in the world and having a spiritual practice is the practice helps you to show up more, that you don't have the privilege of running away from the challenges. You got to step up to them. You have to own up to your own mistakes and learn from them and learn how to communicate with other people in a way that is clear, but also conscious, right? And non-violent. So all of these things, I think, really being in the world and being vulnerable in the world, having a position and, I guess, in some way, a leadership position, a leadership role in some of these different communities that I'm in, have humbled me, right? Because I don't feel that I can be an authentic or even effective leader if I haven't worked through my own shadows, you know? And I value the practice for giving me that. And I value the opportunities to be in this material world of motherhood, of business, of relationships, and helping to keep me humble. And remember what is important. And I realize now more than ever in my own spiritual path that relationship is one of the most, if not the most important thing in life. You know, each other. We got to come back to each other.
Yeah, that's, I was having a conversation with someone who again shares our mutual last name or your part of your last name.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Who I will be actually having a podcast recording with soon, Dr. Michael Platt from the Wharton School of Business. And he's a neuroscientist. And one of the things that he stresses in his research is around connection.
Mm.
And what you've just described at the end of the day is the ultimate. It's what we as the human species are wired for. It's what allows us to survive when we weren't the fastest or the strongest beasts in the jungle or the savannah. So we're wired for this connection. And what I'm hearing is that the practice allows you to come back to that and to recognize at all times that that's an integral, maybe the single most important part of our lives is how we're connected to those whom we love, whom we serve. And we can even broaden that, can't we?
Mm.
Because we're connected to people with whom we disagree, and finding that common ground and having a sense of a breath and saying, you know, I'm feeling the agita, I'm feeling the anger, the fear, the frustration arising. It's like, okay, but you talked about nonviolent communications. Like, so let's have a conversation where I'm going to find out, what do they need?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's really hard. And you talk about leadership.
Yeah.
And that's such an integral part of it, isn't it?
It is. I think, we're in a really interesting time right now with leadership and what that really means. It's actually something that's brewing inside of me as a potential book, but so it's interesting it comes up. But
so that connection as a leader and how important that is in being effective and, you know, being able to keep a team together or whatever and accomplish what you need to accomplish, but taking into account everybody's perspective must be pretty important.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it is a really interesting time for us to evaluate what does leadership mean? What does that look like? How do we, in a sense, lead from within, right? Because part of what our practice gives us is the ability to sit with ourselves, to be fully with ourselves. It can be easy for us to say, yeah, I'm just going to, you know, go off onto a mountaintop or into an ashram and separate myself from the rest of the world. And that's my bliss. But we know, as you mentioned, that that is not what has sustained us as a species over all of these years. That is not what ultimately makes us feel that there is a value to this life. The value in the life is in being able to share it with other people. And in leadership, we need to have that ability to check in with ourselves, to know ourselves, right? To fully understand ourselves in mind, body, and I believe in spirit too. I think that spirituality is a big integral part of being a powerful or effective leader. Do you, like, I think about, right? Like Dr. Martin Luther King or Gandhi or, you know, these leaders that had a practice, a spiritual practice, and a belief in something other than, you know, just having a final goal of achieving the country back or the people back, but just understanding this greater meaning of the world. I think it's so important to bring into our leadership spaces. And it doesn't mean that you have to bring, you know, religion, God, something like, it's just like understanding that we're so much more than our physical bodies and our minds and our thoughts, you know, and that when we have a North Star guiding us, that is about, well, let's just say love, you know, like we all are here together to share in something that is bigger than what our little minds and bodies can achieve. I feel like it galvanizes people, right? It's like we all come behind something, and maybe not to make this very political, but I think that that's why oftentimes we are where we are in this country about like what is meaningful, right? What do we want to get behind that matters? And I think that our meditation practice helps us to do that.
Yeah, I hear so much there, and it resonates deeply with me because I'm thinking at all the different levels, from just family to a team, a division, an organization, a country, and thinking about that connection and understanding what's needed for all of us. So thinking about all these different levels where the connection with individuals, members of our family, our team, our organization, our party, our country, our world, right? And you mentioned, for example, bringing spirituality, and it can be tinged with religion, but really it's a sense of connecting with something bigger than ourselves, mm-hmm. something that is, in a way, divine. Mm. And when we have as a collective a mission that we share, it breaks down a lot of the in-groups that otherwise exist, for sure. But there's something else that I was hearing, and I don't want it to slip away, and that is the goal, the North Star, the mission, that's all incredibly important. But the process or the path is integral, because if we can have a collective goal, but if the path that we take is not the right path and is one that does not take into account the needs of all, humans will suffer. And again, I think we can say this without putting on a blue hat, a red hat, an orange hat, or a yellow hat, mm-hmm. but just saying, okay, and can we collectively say, well, what would we want if we could all sit down together? What would we want? And are there ways that we can move together that will hurt the fewest number of people?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. The process, and it kind of comes back to the importance of the practice and the process, right? That in the practice, you're creating the results. In the path, as you say, in that process is yielding the end result. So it's like, what are we practicing, right? Like, what are those little micro choices that we're making in our lives that's yielding a end result? And is it the result that we want to see? And it's why, as an individual, it's like you change yourself and you change the world. There's a great quote by Rumi that I love. He says, "Once I was clever and I tried to change the world. Now I am wise and I'm changing myself." Just understanding the power of the self in having that ripple effect, right? And it's like, I think we're talking about the importance of each other, right? And yet, the only way, the surest way that we can know that we can experience a world of equanimity, peace, harmony, love, is to establish that inside of ourselves. We sure as hell know we're not going to do it if we're feeling disharmonious and bitter and aggravated inside of ourselves. We wouldn't expect that to lead to a peaceful outcome.
Right.
So that path, and a little bit goes a long way. It's not like we all have to devote ourselves, right, fully to, living in an ashram or meditating multiple times a day. It's just a little bit here and there that you come back to every day. So you set those neural pathways, right, in your brain. You have this remembrance of what it is to return back to that present moment. And you can bring with it. That's why, you know, for me, yoga asana, the yoga poses are so profound, because every pose to me is like a different situation in life. You can have a situation that, like a yoga pose, that makes you agitated and brings up, it evokes a feeling of challenge, maybe a little bit of heat, of work. And it's not that we have to change the pose so that now we feel good and at ease. It's like we hold that, we align ourselves in that, we breathe through that, and then we go through it. And the pose never lasts forever. It's like after a few breaths or moments, it's finished. And then you can take from that experience the information of what that felt like, so that when you're in a challenging situation and you get those same feedback loops, irritation, aggravation, some heat bubbling up, you're like, I know this. I have been here before. I breathed through it. I got on the other side of it, and I'm stronger because of it, right? And I didn't have to curse myself out or anyone else out. I got through it with grace and integrity. So I do think we can learn so much from these really simple tactics that we have in these practices.
Yeah, I think that the wisdom of knowing what your body's telling you, right? And I love that sense of being with the discomfort and working through it. And as a aging athlete, noticing when it's like that hamstring is saying, yep, just take a breath, you can work through it. Or when it's saying, dude,
yes,
stop.
Yes.
And there are times, and there's a difference, right? And the practice allows us to heighten that muscle that says, mm-mm-mm, or the radar, or whatever you want to call it, that sensitivity, just like, yeah, no. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking way back in our conversation about Simone Biles. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about this gymnast who was possibly the greatest gymnast that we've seen in our lifetime. And her decision in Tokyo to say, I can't do it.
Yeah.
No. And you would say, well, you know, along what trajectory did she, because here's someone who has pushed herself obviously her entire life, yeah, and through a great deal of pain and sometimes mental anguish and confusion, but she, no.
Yeah.
So that the lessons we learn tell us what we can support, what we can push through, and what the boundaries are, right? Yeah.
And like such a beautiful example. I just, sometimes when you say Simone Biles, I want to like bring my palms together and like give a little gratitude, a bow to her, because as a former gymnast, I just think what she demonstrated to others as what a value system is, what her value system was. And it wasn't about winning at all costs and getting the gold because everybody else thought that she would, because that's what she was up against, like the pressure of millions and millions and millions of other people and their expectations on her. She rather, her value was her own mental health and her safety and the integrity of her body, which of course is linked to the integrity of her mind. And she demonstrated for everybody, like, if I am not of sound mind, if I am not in like that flow space, like you could see she wasn't in her flow. She just knew that it was dangerous. It was a risk for her. And despite the expectations and, you know, the pressure she had on everybody else, she chose, at the end of the day, she chose her own inner space. And again, like coming back to that was the value for her. It's like, if I am not in alignment here, I don't want to be a part of this. It isn't going to bring me joy. It's only going to lead to destruction in some way. And yeah. I bow down to her for modeling how to say no, you know, mm-hmm. how to establish boundaries as a professional elite gymnast in this kind of really cutthroat environment. And honoring her own, you know, peace of mind over any other prize.
Yeah, I think that honoring herself and what was important to her, her inner values, and it's really difficult. The world was shouting, especially the American media.
Yeah.
Right. So that takes us back to sort of in life when it's maybe not the entire social media and mainstream media, but in our own sort of critic, the chatter that's happening for us, and to be able to say, I hear you, right? Going back to Rumi and the guest house, and it's like, okay, come on in. You know, I know you're not the guest I expected, but you can sit here and you may just ransack my house and take everything with me. But now that you've cleared things out, I guess I've got some space for some new adventures.
Yes. And you know what else? Just one other thing I want to add about this, which I think is so important, is this element of timing, you know, which comes back to surrender, because we might feel like we have an idea. It's like, okay, Tokyo Olympics 2020, that's my time. That's when it's going to happen. It wasn't the right time. 4 years later was the right time. But like when we let go of our expectations or idea of how we think it should be and how, you know, we expect things are going to turn out. And as, you know, Deepak calls it, the wisdom of uncertainty, just like trust in the wisdom of uncertainty, then, like you said, you can be surprised to what and open to what is new, to what is about to come through, because we don't always know. And we have to let go of a sense of timeline. We can be like, in 5 years, I'm going to be here. In 7 years, maybe we're not there. And that could also be exactly where we need to be if we kind of trust that there is a wisdom in the uncertainty, you know?
Yeah, that being able to embrace the uncertainty and embrace the disconnect between what our expected timeline was and where we're at. You know, you think about sometimes, you know, you're on the train or you're on a flight and you have a layover and it's like, oh my God. Now it's like, it's a 4 hour, it's a 5 hour. It's like, okay, there's nothing I can do at this moment.
Yes.
I can be miserable, or I can say, I can catch up on an audiobook I missed. I can go off in a corner and close my eyes, or I can talk to this person over there, can meet a stranger.
Yeah.
Because who, right?
Right.
And so I love that, the wisdom of the uncertain and being open to taking those moments to rethinking. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that recently, and I was thinking about how we're so reluctant. We have this concept of the sunk cost and everything that we've invested in a particular path. Mm. You know, and I'm working on this, and I've spent money and hours and resources, and it's like taking a moment to say, is this serving me? And there are, unfortunately, thousands of people at the top of Mount Everest who thought, I just have to keep pushing through. And that's a conundrum, because yeah. you think, well, you committed so much to get, but at some point, taking that step back and rethinking is like, maybe it's time to turn around.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up. And I keep, there's this concept that we talk about in the Yoga Sutras. It's called Abhyasa Vairagya. And it's sort of everything that we've been talking about in this last hour or so, abhyasa is showing up and doing your practice or doing the thing. And then vairagya is surrendering the outcome, surrendering the results. And this is from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is the classical text of yoga that a lot of modern yoga returns back to as kind of like the philosophy, the manual of the yogic experience. And Patanjali, who is the disseminator of this wisdom, says that this is necessary for growth, for transcendence, for like having and really for manifestation, for anything that we want to create. If we try too hard, we will interfere with that process. But if we don't show up, it's never going to happen. And so this fine line of staying present to what your intention is, being open also to, as you say, turning around and pivoting and moving in a different direction, is really like how we, I think, continue to show up as whole beings, you know, complete and whole inside of ourselves. We don't have to leave any part of ourselves behind when we pivot. We can stay fully present in our intention and what we want to create and how we, what we desire to feel. You know, if we show up fully as we are in the moment and let go of any expectation or attachment to what we think it should be or we should be, I really think that the beauty in people and individuals and humans is just like we're doing right now. It's just like having a real conversation and not knowing what it's going to look like, but we're fully present to each other throughout this entire dialogue. And it's created something really beautiful, you know, that is beyond what either one of us could have imagined.
Right. The beauty of having this conversation without a script. You know, and there's, again, as a teacher, as a podcast host, you know, doing the homework and trying to have, okay, I want to, if we can cover this, but just knowing organically, where does it lead and what feels right? And I also want to emphasize what you're talking about, that that sense of having convictions but being willing to pivot. I think of the image of the strong back, soft front, as you know, Roshi Joan Halifax teaches beautifully on that, and that that reaching this equanimity of, okay, I have principles, I have things I believe in, I have a mission, that's my strong back, and I rely on that. There's support, it's grounded. But I also need to keep my soft front so that I'm accessible to what I can learn and what the universe is, wants to share with me, and to be able to say, okay, it's time to make a change. It's time to shift, and bringing that open mind and that curiosity. And I think, again, I really appreciate the nature of our conversation because, you know, it is unscripted and leads in so many, to me, interesting and unexpected ways. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. And, you know, I bow to your journey. It's been really interesting to watch. You know, and I also salute, you got some important men in your life. First and foremost, my brother. You know, the ultimate dad and brother and husband, et cetera, et cetera. You've got an amazing husband, and I just rejoice in his ability to nurture your personal growth and in such a humble way, allow you to flourish. You know, it's the seeds and watering the flower and just watching this. And so I bowed to him and I bowed to Deepak because he clearly, saw incredible value that you were bringing to him personally as his yoga teacher, but also to his enterprise. And, I am proud of you and I am grateful that you are bringing all the gifts that you have to the world. And above all, I'm really grateful for the time that we spent right now. So Sarah, thank you for being here, for sharing, and for all that you do for this good earth that we have.
Thank you so much, Clayton. I could not be more grateful and feel more nourished from this and from our conversation together and just walking this path with you. It's really so beautiful, and that we can just share in a really loving, supportive way and still be the same people that we are, you know?
I was just thinking, think about like 30 some years ago, who would have thunk? So, on that note, blessings to you and good luck with all that you have coming up.
Thank you so much. Love you.
As always, I want to thank our guests today for sharing their stories, as well as my producer, Marianne Sanders, for all her work behind the scenes, and finally for the support of my friends at Meditation for Leadership through their sponsorship. Until next time, this is Clayton Platt reminding you to look for those moments of magic in your life that lead to mindfulness in real time.